CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 27 with Dr. Terry Kim. Terry Kim is a professor specializing in corneal, refractive, and cataract surgery at Duke University in North Carolina. I've known him for 20 years. We've had some incredible times together, learned so much from each other. In this podcast, we talk about some important things that I didn't realize with his career, how timing is everything. And he explains that how so many different points in his life and his career, timing ended up being the key factor there. Obviously, a lot of talent, too. We also talk about sports vision. He's heavily involved in sports vision, particularly with Duke sports and the Duke basketball team. And he'll explain more about those issues. And then finally, we also talk about fun things like his hobby of being a DJ. So it's a really neat discussion. I think you'll enjoy it. Check it out. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today our very special guest is Terry Kim. Terry is an ophthalmologist at Duke University in North Carolina. Hey, Terry. And Terry has been president of the ASCRS. He's a well-known key opinion leader. He's written 4 books, 400 peer-reviewed articles. I mean, the man works very, very hard. And he bleeds blue. He is Duke through and through, undergrad, med school, and back as for faculty after going away to Emory for residency and then Wills for cornea fellowship. And so Terry's been a great friend and colleague for so many years, and I've always appreciated his keen insight clinically, and I loved to always bounce ideas off of him. So Terry, welcome to our podcast.
Well, hey, Uday, it's great to be here. I'm excited to do this. First of all, congratulations to you on the success of Cataract Coach. I mean, our residents and fellows rave about it. They're on it all the time. And now you've expanded with this podcast. So I'm honored to be part of the group that you've decided the podcast. So I'm glad to be here.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. The goal is we all just want to learn together. And that's the neat part about the whole concept is we're learning together. And you probably know I learn more by making the videos than I do by teaching anyone. And so I get a lot out of it myself. And these conversations, I think, are very important because they give people an insight into, like, what are kind of the career paths and options available for them. Our podcast skews to a younger viewership. Let's say 30s and 40s is typically what we get for our podcast, also our videos. But we have other ophthalmologists, too, like my age, 50s and above. And the one thing they always want to know is, well, how did you end up where you are now? So take us through your path. I said you went to Duke for undergrad and med school. You did Emory for your residency and then Wills for cornea, but you then came back right to Duke. Why is that?
Well, a lot of things you can't plan, Uday. And that was not planned. In fact, it's funny when I see every year we have our fellows come in and they start panicking 2 or 3 months into their fellowship in terms of where am I going to be working? I don't have a job yet. And right. I'll tell you, a lot of things happen last minute,
Right.
And that's what happened to me, Uday. I was in fellowship at Wills. And, I really wanted to do academics, which we can talk about. I had a lot of good influences in my life who are very academic. Tom Auberg, who was our chairman at Emory. Hank Edelhauser, I worked with him in the lab. Doyle Stulting, who is cornea faculty. David Pillay. And of course, I got a lot of influence to go into academics because that's all we know when we're in our training, right? But I ultimately saw myself, I thought I was going to be even private practice because I enjoyed surgery and I really wanted a little freedom in terms of how I was going to, build my practice, etc. So I interviewed at both during fellowship. But one thing that I did, Uday, is I moonlighted. Because maybe I can say this, maybe I can't. They didn't pay me too well at Wills as a cornea fellow.
I think fellows are still quite underpaid.
really underpaid. During those days, which is 97, I was making about 15 grand, not much. So I knew I had to do something. My wife was an intern, so I moonlighted. 2 days a week, or actually I should say 2 days, meaning Saturday morning and Tuesday nights. Good experience in terms of knowing what it would be like to be in a practice. And these were a bunch of Wills alums that were very nice to offer this opportunity. And, it was hard work seeing a lot of patients during that time, but there were a lot of general exams, diabetic retinopathies, refractions, etc. Sure. And that's when I decided I'm not quite ready to go into general ophthalmology. Because most cornea specialists, you know, when you go out, it's rare to walk right into a cornea practice if you're going to do private practice.
Yeah,
if you're going to be doing academia, sure. More likely that you're going to run more into a cornea-specific practice, right? But in private practice, you're not. And I wasn't ready to do that. So that's when I decided, you know what? I'm not ready to make that jump into private practice. I'm going to look at academic options. And I got to be honest with you, there weren't many available at that time. A lot of things go by timing and work by timing and luck. So it was May of my fellowship year. I had already signed up to do a postdoc NIH fellowship with Hank Edelhauser because there were no good academic jobs. I was going to do an extra year of research and then see what became available. And then Gary Foulkes decided to take the chairmanship at Pittsburgh, and I got a phone call to see if I'd be interested in coming back and interviewing for the job. And it was a great opportunity, you know, taking over Gary's practice, full-time academics back at my alma mater. And I remember, you know, I rotated through the Eye Center when I was a medical student and even actually as an undergraduate. So it was great to be back to the place that kind of first introduced me to ophthalmology and got me interested in ophthalmology.
So a lot of it has to do with just kind of the luck of the timing.
Absolutely.
Right? Folks ends up doing a chairmanship somewhere else. A spot opens up kind of last minute.
Yeah.
Wow. So it's, you can't, like you said, you can't plan it. You can't predict it.
You can't. Sometimes you have to go with the flow, you know? I mean, you can do as much as you can to optimize your opportunities, but ultimately, you have no say. Sometimes that's determined for you.
Well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. Now, this is your only job you've had since your training. You've had one job.
Correct.
That's very unusual. Very unusual. Most people go through, you know, jobs like they go through girlfriends or boyfriends. You go through a few before you find the one, right?
And also, I've only had one wife, so just throw that in.
You're a good
man.
You're a good man.
So you're right. So 26 years here at Duke. And let me tell you, I didn't think it would be 27 years. And the advice I will tell you is for folks who are just starting in academia, I think you know after 3 years if it's going to be the right fit for you. Assuming no other factors change, right? Chairman doesn't leave. So in other words, you know, you start your job, right? As an academic, let's say a cornea specialist. I think it takes 3 years to figure it out in terms of whether it's the right fit for you. It takes a little while, in other words, to get settled. So for those folks, and you know, I think you could carry that over to folks who are starting a practice too. Give it a little time for yourself to get settled in. But I will tell you, for me, for instance, Uday, and you know, my advice to folks who are starting academia is, first of all, you know, get your clinical practice settled, okay? Obviously, you know, you get to know your referring physicians, both within your academic center and outside, and start getting active in terms of your research. I mean, in academia, they judge you by your publications, okay? And really what I mean is peer-reviewed publications. So it took me a while to kind of get settled with that and then find your niche. What's going to identify you? What's going to make you the Uday Devgan or the Dick Lindstrom or, you know, whoever it may, the Ed Holland? Find out what your niche is going to be in that field and focus on that because that's what you're going to be known for. And then other things will follow. So for me, after 3 years, coincidentally, there was a chemist that was looking. He was a polymer chemist today at Duke, and he had applied for an NIH R01 grant. You know, very difficult to get, very competitive grant, and he had not gotten funded after two or three tries. And I met him through another researcher at Duke, a PhD, Diane Hatchell. I met her during medical school. And like I said, serendipity in terms of how we met, because she had met this researcher and she said, you know what? There's a new faculty member here. I knew him as a medical student. He did some research with Gordon Clintworth on neovascularization of the cornea. He may be looking for a collaboration. I met with him. His name is Mark Grindstaff. He's now at BU. But he was doing some really interesting polymer chemistry on sealants, adhesives. And he said, I need a wound model. And, you know, what a perfect wound model, the cornea, in terms of looking how sealants work. So I decided to collaborate with him. He was a really solid researcher. I spent so much time. Anyone who's put together an R01 grant will know how much investment and time this takes. And we got funded with a very high score that following year. So, you know, it was a five-year collaboration. We published a bunch of papers, learned a lot about the importance of adhesives and sealants. Because, you know, as you know, Uday, we don't suture that much anymore in the anterior segment, right?
Right, right.
This led to a second renewal. But, you know, the interesting thing about it is this chemist was very smart and said, maybe there's an opportunity to make this a commercial product. So he had another group of sealants that he used with this venture-backed company and formed a company that eventually became a commercially available sealant that got licensed to Beck & Dickinson. And eventually, of course, we then ended up with an FDA-approved sealant, Resure, from Ocular Therapeutics. So it was really cool to see something go from the bench to the bedside, having done all these, you know, basic science investigations. So translational research is so important in what we do. A lot of people today think, oh man, I don't want to look at the Drosophila flies cornea, you know. And a lot of it is not. A lot of it's very, very clinically relevant. So.
Wow, but what a pathway. And we should mention, that's highly unusual to be involved with the project so early on, then take it through the whole process from the bench, then the idea, then it goes obviously to clinical use, and then FDA approval, and then commercial launching, and then wow, widespread use. That's like amazing.
Yeah, pretty cool journey. And I encourage folks, if they have an opportunity to do that, do it. When you're young, you have the time, you have the energy, and it can lead to very exciting things.
So folk, ultra specialized, focus on one particular thing you just love and you're going to be known for. And then don't be afraid when you're young. Just bet it. Bet big. Take some chances. Pursue it, even if it's not fruitful.
I agree with
you. You never know.
Yeah, you never know. You know what? My dad had this saying. I lost my dad to COVID in 2020, actually. Actually, the week before I took on the ASRS presidency. So it was a tumultuous time, I'll tell you that. But he had a saying, Uday, and, you know, I always would look at him and say, you know how kids look at you when you give them advice, they give you this, they roll their eyes. And he would say, you know, Terry, you never know which cloud is going to give you the rain. And I always kind of would look at him funny. And now I kind of understand what he means. You know, first of all, rain could be good. Rain could be bad. And you never know what's going to provide you that good and bad. So try to, if it's a good opportunity that looks promising, take a chance and go for it.
Take some chances. In fact, take chances in multiple things, but don't spread yourself too thin.
That's right. That's important, of course.
So you go, but do you ever think about, well, what if I didn't join Duke? Am I missing out? Do you ever feel like the grass is greener? What if I did private practice? What if I did something else?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So first and foremost, I got to be thankful to Duke in terms of, you know, having me there for 26 years. It's been a great place. And, you know, I first got introduced to Duke, like I told you, when I was an undergrad. Funny story today. So, you know, I was a candy striper. I was a volunteer.
Nice.
And I got assigned to the Eye Center. It was very, again, serendipitous. And I was wheeling a patient into a room, and this gentleman comes up to me and says, oh, I've seen you working very hard as a volunteer. I said, yes. He's like, have you ever seen eye surgery? And I said, no, I've never seen eye surgery. So he says, come with me. So I walk into the scrub room. I'm getting dressed in scrubs. Uday, I have no idea what's going on, okay? I've just been working there for a month, okay?
You don't even know how to scrub.
I don't even know how to scrub. Nothing. I mean, I've seen, my dad was a physician, so I didn't know the Eye Center, OR.
Sure.
So I walk in the room. He enters the room and he starts, and all I can see, because it's all draped, all I can see is this eye sticking out of the sterile drape. And I'm just watching, excuse me. Sorry about that. And I'm just watching this case, and one of the nurses looking over, he's like, wow, you're really lucky to be watching this surgery. I was like, yeah, it is. This gentleman just asked me to come. He goes, you know who that gentleman is? I said, I don't know. That's Robert Mockamer.
Oh, the chairman
of Duke Eye Center and co-inventor of vitrectomy along with Tom Auber, you know, who I also got to, you know, interact with when he was my chair at Embry. So very fortunate to have that chance interaction. He gave me so much good advice. And, you know, I was, you know, and I recommend for folks who are looking to go into ophthalmology, as much exposure as you can get to the field is going to help you decide if that's the right career decision for you. And I was fortunate also to have good advice from my father, who was an OBGYN. And he told me my happiest colleagues are doing ophthalmology. And that's what initially got me to look into it. Very rewarding field, you know, make a big impact. And I think he knew me too. I like to tinker with little gadgets. He knew I was good with my hands, you know. And I got to tell you, Uday, just like for you, I mean, we're both grateful to be in this field, right? To have such a major impact on people's lives, right? On a day-to-day basis, no matter what happens. I've got a bunch of buddies who are in hedge fund and make a lot of money, but they don't have the gratification we do in terms of the impact we have on people's lives, their vision. So I have to be lucky. I consider myself lucky, and this academic journey has led to so many different things. Did I contemplate private practice? Absolutely. And along the way, I did interview at 3 or 4 places that I thought were great opportunities. And ultimately, for one reason or another, I just stayed at Duke. But, you know, when you're in academia, one of the things that's nice is, you know, you get to do other things, right? You're not as worried about the bottom line. You're doing clinical research, sometimes translational basic science research. You also get to do a lot of, you know, clinical trials, which is interesting. And administratively, there are other opportunities. You know, my chairman's the vice dean of education, you know, at the university. One of the things I never thought would happen is doing the eye care for the Duke basketball team. So these are kind of things that kind of happen, some of them by chance. So it's been a great 26 years, and it'll be interesting to see what the future holds.
Yeah, so interesting you brought up the Duke basketball team. So obviously you're involved in that, and that kind of got you started in sports vision. Tell me about your work in sports vision, because that's like a new subset that we never even heard about a decade ago.
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you what I did, and I guess this is one of those things we talked about, you know, take a chance, right? So I came back. And I asked, you know, back when I started in 97, Uday, a lot of the guys that I went to Duke College with were now associate or assistant coaches. So, you know, they were friends, and I reached out, you know, one day over a beer, I was like, hey, who does your eye care? And it was being farmed out to this community ophthalmologist who had no ties to Duke. But he had a relationship with the trainer, which is why that happened. But these kids had to drive off campus. It was very difficult. Logistically, it didn't make sense. So I said, you know what? I'd love to do the eye care for the team. So I started off by doing the trauma care, you know. And who wants to deal with that? Well, you know, I said, something cool that I could give back to do, you know. And I was surprised to see some of the injuries that came through, you know.
Of
course, corneal abrasions, that's the most common. We had some crazy conjunctival lacerations, you know, orbital fractures from folks who were just getting hit in the eye, you know. So after about a year of that, Uday, I approached one of the assistant coaches and I said, hey, who does your eye screening? And they're like, eye screening? What are you talking about? This is a Division I top-tier basketball program, Uday, where these guys go to their physical and read an eye chart off the back of a door. So I approached Coach K and said, you know, I'd like to bring my team in and do an annual eye screening for the team. We'll do it, you know, before the season starts, and I'll bring it to you. He loved the idea, and it's been, oh, gosh, now – over 20 years, and it's been an incredibly rewarding experience and an incredibly educational experience. We published already 2 papers on what we found: glaucoma suspects, keratoconus suspects, uncorrected refractive error. I mean, and you know, for lay people, they don't understand, you know, what it means to get an eye screening and the impact of glaucoma. If you look at Kirby Puckett, for instance, was one of the Minnesota Twins that got diagnosed with glaucoma at a very late stage, lost his eye. We were surprised. Jabari Parker had uncorrected refractive error. He was one of our big starting freshmen. He was kind of a one-and-doneer, but he wouldn't have even passed a driver's test with his vision.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, we got him in contacts, you know. We had one player, Uday, who came in, didn't realize he had cataract surgery in one eye as a child. Was pseudophakic in the eye, 2400. Just assumed he couldn't see. And with refraction, we got him to 2040. So he went from monocular all of a sudden to binocular vision. It opened up his world, got him in a contact lens. How crazy is that, you know? I'll tell you
why contact lenses? You should be doing their LASIK.
Well, no. He's pseudophakic in that eye, but you know, it was a high error. He had grown out of the IOL.
Hard to do.
Plus 10 LASIK, right? So the most, I think, touching story I have to tell you was what happened to our current head coach, Uday. John Shire is our head coach. I don't know if you follow Duke basketball, but those of folks who do know that he led our team to a national championship in 2010. And then right after that, he's working out with the Miami Heat in Las Vegas. That's where they do their summer tryouts. Okay. Playing great, was going to make the Miami Heat team. He was going to be on LeBron's team with Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh.
Wow.
He's inbounding the ball during a scrimmage, during his tryouts. Someone reached out to get the ball. This guy, Joe Ingles, who actually some people may know, accidentally hit John's eye. John hits the floor. Doesn't get up. I get a call that night from John. And he says, hey, Doc. I said, hey, John, what's up? He's like, yeah, I'm at tryouts. I got hit in the eye pretty bad. I can't see. And I said, John, that's not good. Can I speak to the ER doc? So I speak to the ER doc. I was impressed, actually. Most ER docs are not able to give you a good translation of what's going on with the eye. But this guy says he's counting fingers, cannot see. Cornea looks clear, but he asked me, Uday, does he have glaucoma? And I said, no. You know, these athletes all have 0.1 cups and pink nerves. Most of them are 20/20, right? Or better. And I said, no, he doesn't. But that made me kind of think. I was like, that's odd. I talked to John. I said, you need to fly back here. We need to give you a full. He goes, Doc, I'm already heading back home to Chicago. Is there any way you can get someone to see me there? So I'm good friends with and colleagues with Kirk Pacco, very well-known retina specialist there. And he's very sports-oriented. He's done a lot of stuff in his practice. I've done so much stuff in sports vision. Get him to see him the next day. Uday, he calls me to say that John has an optic nerve head avulsion.
What?
He had an optic nerve head avulsion from a finger going to the eye.
Oh, my goodness.
So I flew up to Chicago that weekend, and I spent the weekend with him and his parents in the hospital bed where he was admitted. You know, they were trying some IV steroids. And, of course, he never got his vision back. He tried. You know, I'll tell you, that 72 hours were the toughest for him and his family. That kid never cried once. And he told me as I left his room, he said, Doc, thanks so much for coming. But, you know, this is just a sign that I was meant to do something else in life. Well, he tried. Wow. He went and played in Israel, Spain, tried, came back and played for the D League. Now it's called the G League with the Austin Toros. Coach K gives him a call and says, would you like to be one of my assistants for the Duke basketball team? So he comes. He's done an awesome job and, of course, gets handed that throne, which is, you know, a huge, huge, huge shoes to fill. So, you know, it's a crazy story. And John tried to adapt to playing with one eye, but it's tough. Believe it or not, there are some monocular players out in the NBA. Most of them, though, Uday, have had monocularity since a young age. So they've adapted to it.
They're used to it.
You know, for John, it was very sudden. So it didn't happen. But, you know, I was glad to be, you know, of help. And I wish there was, you know, a better outcome. But it ended up, you know, for him being a great opportunity in terms of his coaching career.
Wow. Makes you think. Maybe all the basketball players should be wearing those Kareem Abdul-Jabbar goggles.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you're a Laker fan, right? I mean, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was always wearing those. You know, not many people were. You know, Kirk Pacco, the crazy thing, if anyone knows Dr. Pacco, they'll know. A week after he saw John, he sent me a 40-slide PowerPoint presentation on 8 patients he had seen with partial or total optic nerve head avulsions from basketball, from getting hit in the eye, either with a finger or elbow. Yeah. Crazy, right?
Yeah, I mean, the amount of force, I guess, can be incredible, right? And such fast forces, you can't prepare for it.
That's right.
Wow. That's right. So, what a foray into sports vision. So, are there ways to give us, like, you know, even superhuman vision? Should we be doing, like, for some of these athletes?
Well, I'll be honest with you, Dave. I mean, you've worked with athletes, right? I mean, I think the why this has happened and the trajectory it's taken in sports vision is because they've been able to kind of work with the athlete on every other element, right? Physical conditioning, right? All these, you know, skills or drills, etc. But they haven't thought about vision, which is why it's, you know, in discussions now. And I will tell you, there are a lot of devices out there that claim to help with vision performance. And we've been studying them at Duke. There's nothing really peer-reviewed, however, to validate these tests in terms of the field performance impact it makes. We've done some studies that show these tests do help with hand-eye coordination, and they perform better on these tests that they're doing, but we haven't found, does it help in field goal percentage? Does it help in free throw percentage, et cetera? That hasn't been shown yet. And those are some studies that we're trying to do now. Baseball is probably the most prominent. You heard about this, being able to see the spin of the ball when it's being pitched. But I still think that translation in terms of the impact of these tests and on the field performance improvement hasn't been shown. Stephon Curry is a big fan of this. He does a lot of this, and I don't know if this was in the Wall Street Journal. I was interviewed for an article because, you know, he was diagnosed with keratoconus, you know?
Sure.
He's big on these tests. But again, we haven't been able to show the clinical correlation of doing these tests and better on the field performance.
Wow. Remains to be seen. My anecdotal evidence is from treating some baseball players. And you would think that, you know, fix the refractive error, their low degree of myopia, make them absolutely spot on plan, or even a plus a quarter hyperopic with LASIK, and they'll have incredible vision. They were all very happy, except one player said he was -2, and we made him absolutely bang on plano. And he said, but now the ball looks smaller when I'm at bat. So it's like, well, I didn't really think of that. Yeah, but I guess you're right. I'm seeing it at -2. It's a blur, but at least it's bigger.
Yeah.
You know
what's interesting too, I'll tell you, Uday, I mean, there are folks, we've had some prominent folks, you know, Kyrie Irving's one of them, didn't have 20/20 vision, but had good vision, you know, and they acclimate to that vision. And in basketball, you may not need that 20/15 or 20/10 as much as maybe a baseball player, because the ball's fairly big. You're looking at, you know, a rim, right? So it's interesting. I think it really varies from sport to sport as well.
Wow, such a neat topic. I think more and more people are going to get interested in this topic as the years go on. I think it's a really fascinating topic here. Tell me some other stuff you're involved with research now. So obviously years ago you did the sealant stuff. What's kind of new and breaking, you think, at least from your perspective, on the cataract side or refractive or even IOL side?
Well, I mean, you know, I think the ophthalmologist that's coming out of practice now is probably inundated with, you know, all the new technologies that was out there. I mean, let's just take, for instance, cornea, okay? I mean, when I was in residency and fellowship in 96, 97, Uday, I mean, we were learning to do full thickness corneal transplants as our main procedure. That was it, okay? Even refractive surgery was just starting to hit the mainstream. Because I was in residency at Emory where, you know, Keith Thompson, George Waring, and Dol Stulting, those are the guys that got were instrumental in getting FDA approval for LASIK, right? So refractive surgery was just starting, but we didn't have any lamellar corneal transplant procedures. We didn't know much about ocular surface. I mean, now we've got so much that we know about the corneal surface that we're trying to improve. Let's then move to cataract IOL. You know, when I was in, you tried to decide which monofocal lens you're going to put in. And now look at the plethora, and you deal with this on a day-to-day basis. I'm sure with the patients with high demands and expectations in your area coming in, what about this multifocal IOL? How about this EDOF lens? And now you have the LAL, you know? So a lot of, you know, great, exciting technologies. You know, what excites me in terms of what's the future? I think you're getting at, what's the future of cornea cataract refractive surgery? Well, I think one is going to be customization of the IOL. I think it's really exciting. I think LAL, for instance, is a start there in terms of customizing the power of that lens and being able to correct some toricity. I think, you know, technologies like the perfect lens is going to be pretty disruptive. I mean,
right? We had Randy Olson on the podcast, episode 13, and he talked all about that refracted and shaping with a femtosecond laser. You can basically alter any existing IOL in the eye to essentially have better than 20/20 vision for your entire life.
Very disruptive.
That's amazing.
That's going to change the playing field, right? So that's certainly exciting. And then in terms of the customization of the IOL, and I think the other disruptive innovation that I see happening right now is robotic cataract surgery.
Oh yeah, for sure.
You know, I have a, you know, buddy of mine who's a urologist, and robotics plays a huge role in his practice. And I think we're saying that JP Hubschman is working on technology. We're seeing some companies in Israel and other countries looking at this. And you're going to start hearing about robotic cataract surgery within the next few years.
I'm actually working with JP at Horizon Surgical. Their home office is, you know, 15-minute drive from my house. And so we've been working together. And my disclosure, I'm an investor in the company. So, but don't follow my advice. just want to put that out there. But no, I think a lot of neat things are coming. I think one important point is that what you learned in your training, you had one of the best residencies, you had one of the best fellowships. That was not sufficient to practice your career. That's merely the building blocks, the base. And you have to teach yourself. You didn't learn lamellar surgery for the cornea in any kind of fellowship. You learned it on your own.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point. I think being in academia has forced me to stay on the cutting edge. And I'll give you a good example of that. You know, I'm a pretty busy transplant surgeon. I was doing, for instance, a lot of DSEC, okay?
Okay.
And we were getting thinner and thinner tissue, you know? It went from 120 microns to 80 microns. We're getting 40 micron tissue. So the obstacles that you had with thicker transplants, such as, you know, hyperopic shifts and limited visual acuity, we're getting less and less, and these patients are getting great outcomes. So when DMEC came around, we were like, why do we need to do DMEC? We're getting great outcomes with DSEC. But you know what? The fellows are what forced us to do it, because fellows were wanting corneal fellowships that offered DMEC.
Right.
And I realized we have to make this jump, which I did. And I'm so grateful for it, because I was happy with my DSEC outcomes. But now DMEC has become my primary procedure for patients who have straightforward Fuchs and a cataract and or cataract. So I'm doing a DMEC or DMEC triple on these patients as opposed to what I was doing before, DSEC. So I do feel blessed to be in an environment where you have energetic trainees. You know what I'm talking about.
Sure,
absolutely. Eager. And they also have great ideas, you know, because There's no filter, you know. They're out there trying to, you know, just ask these questions, which sometimes, you know, lead to incredible discoveries. But that's what forced us to kind of move into DSEC, into DMEC, and that's one of the reasons why we've tried to keep our fellowship cutting edge.
Absolutely, I think it's important that you do that, and it's even for me when I was teaching residents. I retired last year, but prior to that, I taught myself DMEC. We've got a host of great DMEC videos on Cataract Coach meant for beginners to go from step one to like, how do I do this? And here's some great pearls from absolute experts. And so I think, it's important. You got to keep teaching yourself and keep evolving your practice, whether you're in academics or whether you're in your private practice. You can't be stagnant. You don't want to be that old doctor who says, oh, yeah, I'm doing things the way I learned them 30 years ago, and I'll never change. You don't want to be that person.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I think back to when the first multifocal IOL was approved, okay? And I'm sure you and I went through the similar thought process, like, am I going to do this or not? Because I'm sure, right. You know, we heard people who weren't happy, the typical things you hear with the unhappy multifocal IOL patient. But, you know, I sat there. First of all, we're fortunate to be in a field, right, where we're able to offer a patient advanced technology IOL that's going to give them better benefits and to get reimbursed for that effort, right? Because there are many fields you don't even have that luxury, okay?
Right.
But I really thought that was the future moving forward. So I did invest my time and effort in putting these lenses in. It also, you know, as a corneal surgeon, I knew refractive surgery, so it gave me the ability to enhance if needed. And I also was doing a lot of IOL exchanges. And I'll tell you, if you get skillful at IOL exchange and can do refractive surgery, you're going to feel a lot more comfortable in implanting these lenses because you know you can take them out or you can fix them, you know? So
right.
I think that also allows you, by making that decision, to evolve your skill set to do other things that are related to that primary goal, which may be, you know, implanting multifocal or advanced technology IOLs.
Right, you bring up a great point. You have to be able to do either the IOL exchange or do some corneal refractive surgery to enhance your outcomes, because a lot of the reason that sometimes multifocal patients are not happy is that the refractive target wasn't hit precisely enough.
Exactly. That's right. That's the most common. If you look at that, it's usually cylinder that gets missed, right? So
right.
Start with toric IOL. Start with astigmatism management, which you just teach in your courses. You know, you teach them, sure. You know, at all the meetings. That's important. And once you feel comfortable with that, I mean, we're all going to get that refractive surprise, no matter how good
course,
a surgeon you are. You know, these high hyperopes are tough, right? Of course, right. High myopes, etc. So if you feel comfortable, the more you feel comfortable with your, you know, biometry, then, you know, you start offering these lenses and you can fix those surprises that you get either with IOL exchange or with a laser refractive procedure. And LAL, of course, has, you know, changed that game now, right? So we already have technology available to us that allows us to address that.
That's, yeah, all great points. I think, yeah, we're kind of in a sweet spot here. I'm kind of sad that I'm mid-career. I wish I was early in my career. So many neat things are coming out.
I want to ask you, I mean, so you're slowing down on the teaching, and I wanted to bring something up maybe that you and your audience would enjoy, because I can only imagine what it's like to have you in the OR Uday teaching, you know. And, you know, as we all know, patients, even though they may not be able to see during the surgery, they can hear during their surgery. Sure. So, you know, one of the things I've learned, you know, when I've been teaching fellows and residents for 26 years is you have to be careful what you say in the OR.
Of course.
Right?
Of course.
So I remember, this is a funny story, Uday, when Aura first came out, intraoperative aberrometry. I remember one of my first patients, and I'm saying, okay, Karen, look at that light. Look at that light. And she's not cooperating. She's not looking at that light. And, you know, it's like, come on. We're like, you know, I'm trying to spend time with this patient. And the anesthesiologist leans over and says, hey, Dr. Kim, her name is Katie. So it makes a difference when you know the name of the patient in terms of getting that attention. Just a little pearl. Just a small little pearl. But the other thing I was going to tell you, Uday, is I can imagine when you have a resident, because you have some crazy videos and they're so educational, you know, and it is good to see these things because, you know, anything can happen when you're in the OR, right? But I always wondered what you did when someone had a problem, but you didn't want the patient to hear when that resident made an error. So I just thought, like, you know, something like this could be helpful. These, you know, like, you know, throwing this off for,
for our audience, he's holding up a sign that says stop and now a sign that says back up. If you're listening to the audio podcast, Terry's holding up like the signs here.
And maybe, you know, if you see some crazy thing there, you know.
It says WTF, then, what the French?
You know.
And the shame on you.
You know.
You have these already prepared?
You know what's funny? I'll tell you.
Those Duke residents, they must be giving you a lot of grief.
Uday, I thought about this on my drive because this is actually some size that my daughter got that she keeps in her car when she drives. So when, you know, this road rage thing has gotten kind of crazy, right?
People, oh, my goodness.
A lot more. So she does these things on the road. But I thought this could be very transferable. You could have your own cataract series, the cataract coach signs. You know, as a coach, you need to translate your feelings to the resident non-verbally so the patient doesn't hear it. So I don't know, just something, you know, that's no financial interest.
Well, yeah. Listen, I love teaching. I think I did a fantastic job. In a UCLA who has more than 100 faculty, one teaching award a year, no one has ever received it twice. I won it five times. So I'm done. I've achieved what I need to achieve. But what I did in the award, my key was that, that's interesting. And then when residents are operating cataracts, let's say sitting temporal, I'd sit superior. I actually, as a kid, started off lefty and then switched to right-handed. So I can do both. So if I sit at 12 o'clock to a 10, and it's, let's say the resident's operating temporally on a left eye, I can just, from the assistant scope, finish the entire case with my left hand.
Yeah.
Or like if it's famous... a right eye, I can do the right, finish the whole thing.
Yeah, like a famous ACC basketball player said, so you're amphibious, right? So you're amphibious.
Amphibious, ambidextrous. We'll take whatever you got. But yeah, I don't mind doing it. So no, it was a fantastic time. But just I did love the young energy of teaching the residents and then the brightness in their eyes when they learned something new. I think that was an amazing thing.
Right.
But I had higher standards. I did demand, I'd say, okay, we're going to meet tomorrow morning before the award 7. And I'd say, not 7:01. We're meeting at 7.
Yeah.
So if you show up at 7:02, you're not going to operate. I'm going to do the cases for you.
Yeah. I've got to. So I like.
I had only one rule.
What was the rule?
My one rule for residents. Only one rule. You give the same treatment that you want to receive. If your eye having surgery or your mom, your dad. What do you want? You want the surgeon to come in there late? No. You want the surgeon to be absolutely on time? Absolutely. You want the surgeon to know everything about your case, to be well prepared, to give you his or her best. And that's it. And then I learned that in kindergarten.
Yeah. And you know what? As much as you say the audio cues, like you said, interesting. I mean, how much more direct can you get? You know, you can just, that's the beauty, you know. You can just put this up, you know.
For our audio people, he's holding a sign that says, "You just broke the posterior capsule." I don't know how you get those signs sterilized for the hour, but I appreciate the humor. If you're watching it on YouTube, you obviously enjoy it more than just the podcast. But no, it's a neat thing to teach residents. But yeah, the other thing too is that if you're a resident doing your training now, just know that there's a variability in skill set. But with enough hard work, you could all achieve the same milestones. So going back to your basketball analogy, if you get people straight in first week of residency and have them throw basketball free throws, you'll get a variable response from very low percentage to very high. But if they all practice, and some practice far more than others, I bet they can all achieve 90% from the free throw line.
You're right. Any professional golfer will tell you Tiger Woods is one of the hardest working golfers out there. He was on the practice range all the time. So I agree with you. You know, the other thing I think that's overlooked, Uday, which, you know, all the teaching, I know you did an episode with Dick where you talked about filming the OR, right? The back scenery, like what people don't see. And this kind of relates to that because so much teaching that we do in ophthalmic surgery is related to the specifics and the details of what's going on intraocularly, right?
Right.
And I think there's so much, and what I do with my fellows and residents when they first start is just teaching ergonomics, okay?
Yeah, we got a good video for that.
Where your arms are. Yeah, where your hands sit, but also posture. Because you and I have seen so many people, and it's hitting us now too, right? If you have a bad posture, because you get used to what you start developing, there's a lot of surgeons in general, but also ophthalmic surgeons who are having cervical spine issues because of bad posture. So I think those are just things that are important for the younger ophthalmologist to get in a good habit.
Absolutely. In fact, we have a full 25-part curriculum series.
Curriculum.
Full curriculum. Each lesson's about 40, 45 minutes, and there's 25 of them. Meant to be done one a week, and you'll get through it in 6 weeks, 6 months, or if you do it one every other week, you get through it in a year. But there's a whole one exactly about ergonomics, setting up your operating room, so you don't have these issues. And I also, one thing I didn't mention in the curriculum, though, is weightlifting. I'm telling you, having the additional muscle mass and the strength, I never get back aches, I don't have shoulder aches, I don't have neck aches.
Interesting.
But I lift hard. I think it makes a huge difference.
Wait, are you telling me your body looks like Rosa Braga Meals now? Is that what you're saying? I mean, are we going to see you in these bodybuilding contests?
Not yet, but I'm one of the very few ophthalmologists that Rosa has not beaten in arm wrestling. She has not, right? So I'm good. Do not worry, bro.
All right, I'm going to have Rosa on this one because, you know, you don't mess with Rosa. You and I both know that.
I'll see her next month at a meeting in Ottawa. So don't worry. I'm going to be in Canada next month. I'll hang out there. She's an amazing person. She was actually my podcast guest 3 episodes ago. So.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
Not yet released. We do these in advance.
Okay.
So, now tell me, let's switch gears out of ophthalmology. People may also know you, that you are a fantastic, like literally, professional DJ. How'd you get into DJing of all things?
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, Uday, one advice that I would give to your audience, because you said you have that audience that is around that 30 to 50 age range, is work-life balance. I think work-life balance is so important. I think people get so tuned in to their work and having a successful practice and being successful in general, sometimes the blinders come up. And you start losing sight of your personal life and your hobbies, you know? And that's why I bring this up, because DJing was a hobby of mine. Like my dad said, you never know which cloud's going to give you the rain. I studied classical piano like every good Asian kid did growing up with a musical instrument. And I think it actually helped my ambidexterity, Uday, to play piano. But
sure.
You know, I knew I wasn't going to be a classical pianist. Neither did my parents. So my friend and I in senior year in high school, I bought a DJ mixer. I bought my first Neumark mixer from Crazy Eddie's. And I just wanted to play with it. And so he and I started mixing tapes. We started doing parties. So that was my first intro to DJing. This is all in the analog days, Uday.
Wow.
So I would carry my milk crates of 12-inch mixes to these parties. And then, of course, when college started, medical school, residency, I didn't have time.
Sure.
So I was at an academy meeting in 2009. Okay. And I ran into Tony Aldave, who's a cornea specialist at Jules Stein. And, you know,
also a DJ.
That's right. He's one of my co-DJs that we've been DJing together for past 10 years. And we were at a conference or advisory board meeting, and I asked him, what'd you do this, past few months this summer? And he said, my wife got me DJ lessons. And I was like, they do lessons for DJ now? So he's like, yeah, and I'm really into it. And he said, you should check it out. So he gave me the website. I downloaded the software and I was like, wow, this is a lot easier than it was 15 years ago or 20 years ago when it was all analog and I was doing everything by hand. And I picked it up and I said, wow, this is really cool. Got me back into mainstream music, And at that time, we were both part of the Cornea Society, and Cornea Society was looking to rejuvenate their social events at these meetings, They wanted younger people. They wanted something different. So I approached Gail Radio and I said, hey, how would you feel if Tony and I, did a DJ event? And she looked all starry-eyed and I was like, that would be such a huge crowd pleaser to attract these young people. But we told them it was not going to be a wedding event. It can't be in a hotel ballroom. It's got to be in a club. So we did our first event in 2010 for ASCRS in Boston at this club called Felt. About 200 people showed up. And it just took a life of its own, Uday. We always do it at Academy at Ascaris on a Friday night. I mean, the last few have been at the Hard Rock Cafe in Las Vegas, LA Live. These are huge. House of Blues in San Diego. As you know, you've been there. 2,000 people show up. But what's really cool is, number one, it allows me to do something different. You know, when you go to these meetings, you come home and your significant other always says, why are you so tired? you were just in a nice location at a meeting. And they don't realize the work we put in, you know, when we're doing these meetings. And a lot of us are running from meeting to meeting, the presentation to presentation. We don't oftentimes have an opportunity to take time for ourselves. So it was great to take a break. And instead of me trying to figure out what I'm going to lecture on for this meeting the next day, I'm thinking about what songs I'm going to put in my playlist, you know. And it's a great also social break in terms of interacting with your colleagues to see them out there dancing and getting into the music. So it's been a wonderful, I feel fortunate, you know, hobby that's grown into something that I've been able to do, you know, within my specialty at our meeting. So, and we've done it for other things.
Combine the two. That's neat.
Exactly. It's been really fun. So, and I've done some mixes too that I'm trying to get more into that too, doing some mixes that I've recorded. I did one during COVID, so I'll send it to you. But anyway,
I'd love to have it. Send it over.
Yeah. Yeah. Now that COVID's over and we're back to in person, you know, we hope to introduce this to the meetings, maybe in San Francisco or for Academy, or perhaps in Boston, 2024 for the ASCRS meeting.
Wow, amazing! I didn't realize you've been doing this since high school, 40 years.
Yeah, but you know, it was a big break. I mean, the real stuff started in 2010 in terms of what we're doing now. But it's been so much fun. You know, you'd be surprised at how much talent there is in our field, you know? Raymond Stein's a refractive surgeon up in Canada. He came up to me one day and said, "Hey, I see these DJ events. Do you mind if I play some saxophone with you at one of them?" I was like, saxophone? I didn't understand. He shows up with a soprano saxophone and we're playing music and he's just improvising in the background, you know, playing his saxophone.
So cool.
So, and, you know, there are a bunch of band members in our field, you know, who are talented musicians. So it's kind of cool to see the talent. And that's what I'm telling your younger audience. If you have a hobby that you've done, don't forget it. It may resurface later on and help provide that work-life balance, because it's not only about the office or the ASC. There's more to life, which is important.
Yeah, we've done a lot of episodes on that in the past. I've been very poor. 20 years ago, I was terrible at work-life balance. I was such a workaholic. And then I tried to change gears and then prioritize my kids again, which I thought was very important. And then now I've kind of finally, after 20 years, found a reasonable balance of work-life and family and friends and professional. I think it's a work in progress for a lot of people, especially for me.
Well, you know what? It's important that you realize that, right? Better late than never.
Sure.
Because life is short. And you want to enjoy, you know, what you have, your family, certainly important, your staff, et cetera, the people around you, our colleagues, our friends, you know. Boy, what a tough time. When I took that, as I told you earlier, Uday, that April, late April, early May was a tumultuous time. I lost my dad to COVID, took over ASCRS as president, and found out that we had to cancel our meeting, you know. It was my heart just sank, because, you know, I was looking forward to getting together. It was 2020, you know, 2020, symbolic year. Coach K was my guest speaker for the meeting. I mean, we had all these great things planned. All that came to a halt, and we really, you know, had to look at survivorship for our organization, for ASCRS, had to convert to a virtual meeting in a very short time. And I'll tell you, Uday, that was one of the first certainly the first major virtual meeting for ophthalmology, but even for medicine. And we learned so much in terms of making that conversion. And it was a huge success. And, you know, we thank our industry partners who invested in this, obviously a critical part in what we do, and also to our fellow members, right? Our surgeons who attended it and showed up. And as you all know, we live in this hybrid society now. So it's obviously a part of what we do. Some of the activities that we do at Duke still are virtual, but there's nothing that can replace that, you know, personal interaction that we have in face-to-face meetings. Yeah, for sure.
For sure. Out off of the podium, in the hallways, in the restaurants, in the nightclub, when you're DJing. Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, think about all the pearls that you've picked out that were not during, you know, a conference meeting session taking place, but the sidebar conversations that take place, you know.
For sure. Absolutely. So you've had 27 amazing years at Duke. What do you have for the next 27 years at Duke? What's coming in your future? How do you see this planning out? How does it play out for you?
That's a good question, Uday. That's a good question. Our field is evolving so quickly. And I can tell you right now, I don't know. Maybe I'll be at Duke for the rest of my career, or maybe I'll decide to take a left turn and do something else. A lot of opportunities there. You know, we're fortunate, again, to be in a field where the opportunities are ample. I think we're fortunate to be a field where we're so closely aligned with our industry partners. There are a lot of fields where they don't get together. There's not that close collaboration. Sure. Obviously, technology is so intricate to what we do in bringing our patients the best, right? And that's what we're all here for, is to bring our patients the best technology, the best surgery, the best skill set, et cetera, to give them the best vision, right? It's such a precious sense that so often we take for granted until you lose it. So right. I feel fortunate that we have these collaborations, and that's what also gives me more options. So we'll see. Time will tell. I'll certainly keep you posted.
I will appreciate that. And then, hey, you never, like you said, sometimes things are just timing. Sometimes it's just luck. You just take it as it comes.
Right. Yeah,
it's kind of like playing pickup basketball. You kind of know what your goal is, to put the ball in the net, but you don't know exactly what moves you're going to be doing. You just kind of take it as it comes.
That's right. And you certainly don't want to get hit in the eye, but you also never know when you're going to sprain that ankle, you know?
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Well, Terry, I had an amazing time chatting with you. Thank you so much for sharing so much insight and some incredible stories in your path in ophthalmology.
You know what's fun when you don't realize the time has passed? I can't believe it's already been an hour, Uday. It's been a great, great hour chatting with you, and I hope your audience gets something out of it. It's certainly been a pleasure for me.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks for enjoying that podcast with me. And do me a favor, subscribe to our podcast, click on that little button there, tell your friends about it, and also drop me a comment. Let me know who you'd like to have on as a future guest. We're making a new podcast every week. See you next week.